he wants to take me again.
What's up, creeps? It's your boy Christian Mingle, and we have made it to episode 3. Now, before we get started, I want to address some audio issues with today's episode. Firstly, I'm recording today's introduction while out of town and away from my recording equipment, so if it sounds a bit off, well, that's why. Secondly, today's interview was actually recorded pretty early on in my process of putting together this podcast, so I wasn't quite aware until after the recording that my guest's audio was a little bit fuzzy. I think I did a good job of cleaning it up for you, though we do still have some static towards the end. But I encourage you to listen all the way through, as it's a pretty interesting interview, especially during that staticky part, and I think it's easy to ignore all that extra noise. So for today's film, we are looking at a little cult indie flick that mostly flew under the radar. As far as I know, not many people have seen this movie or even heard of it, but it's a really fun film, and it's not super scary. So if you're looking for something to watch with somebody who's not often into the genre, it might be a good choice. If you haven't seen it, or if it's been a while and you want to revisit it, it is currently available to stream for free on Tubi and Pluto TV. So go ahead and check it out, then come on back, and you'll have a bit more context for today's episode. Otherwise, let's jump right into our interview with Grampy Knockers. So today we are joined by my good friend Heather, otherwise known as Grampy Knockers. Heather is a theater artist. We met through theater when I moved to Philadelphia and auditioned for Heather's theater company, Thespianage. We have a pretty extensive performance background together. Heather and I both perform burlesque as Grampy Knockers and Christian Mingle, as you know. And we've done quite a few numbers together, and they usually involve food or something related to food. So, Heather, I always ask my guests to self-identify before we get started, just so the listeners know who they're talking to, and that way I know how to properly address you. So I'll go first. I identify as a gender non-conforming, cis, white, pansexual, queer man. My pronouns are generally he, him, but I appreciate any pronoun, really. Heather?
Yes, I am a gender non-conforming, cis, white, queer, AFAB person. I'm a little bit femme of center most of the time, but I like to go on both sides of that. And, pronouns. I have no pronoun preference whatsoever. There's not a pronoun you could throw at me that would be a problem for me.
Wicked. Same here. Loves it. And Heather, I also always like to ask, what is your connection to horror?
I am not a big fan of horror because I have sort of generally nightmares as what I dream about most nights. And I don't love to add the visuals of horror to it, but I do. Sometimes I get very into like a special effect and I'm like, that's so cool. And I like break it down and I forget and then I feel better.
Yes, that's fun. We love that. We love taking a newbie through it. All right. Awesome. So we are going to jump into today's film. So today we watched May from 2002. This is written and directed by Lucky McKee. Typically, I really love a film that is written and directed by the same person because I feel like you get a really true sense of their vision. But sometimes I think those situations could also benefit from maybe a second eye. And I think in the case of the script, specifically the stuff with Anna Faris's character, which we'll get into, maybe could have used a little, I don't know, second touch or something. All right, so let's get right into the summary. What is this movie about? So we have our main character, May. May is born with a lazy eye. May's mother has some serious perfection issues. She's really concerned with May's lack of friends and is even further concerned that May's lazy eye is going to perpetuate that. So kind of to alleviate the fact that May has no human friends, her mother gives her a homemade doll named Susie, who lives in
a glass case, very Annabelle style for those who are familiar. She tells May that you cannot take Susie out of the case, that she has to stay perfect, while telling May, if you can't find a friend, make one. So then we do a cut to May as an adult. She is wearing glasses and contact lenses to adjust her lazy eye. She lives alone. She has no friends, as we can see, but she is surrounded by dolls. So her doll collection has grown from the singular Susie in the glass case to now a whole plethora of dolls, very, very serial killer status. Lots of shelves of dolls just staring at her from her apartment. May works as a veterinary's assistant. She works alongside receptionist Polly, who is played by Anna Faris. Polly is, the best way to describe Polly is like a hyper femme lesbian fuckboy. we'll get into her. Let's not, I can just get sidetracked on Polly's character. So long. Let's just continue with the summary. So one day May sees a gentleman, Adam, working on a car, and she is really taken by his hands. She develops a stalker-like crush on Adam and starts watching him from afar. It appears that they work somewhere near each other, so she'll take breaks from work and kind of hang out by the garage where he works to see him on his breaks, or she even tries kind of like crossing paths with him and bumping into him on the street a few times. So eventually May is able to connect with Adam, and the two develop a unlikely but slow romance. Adam says that he's really into weird stuff, and May identifies as weird, so it seems kind of like a perfect match. At one point, Adam shares this kind of creepy art school movie that he's made, and May is really into it. It kind of turns her on. They start hooking up, and May tries to reenact the film, part of which involves biting Adam, causing him to bleed, and he gets really freaked out by that and ends up dumping her. So May then turns her attention to Polly, the receptionist. They have a little mini kind of like one night thing, but then May starts to realize that, as we said, Polly is a fuckboy, and she finds out that Polly is also dating a girl named Ambrosia, like the delicious dessert. So May, still desperate to find a friend, starts volunteering at a school or a daycare for blind children. She particularly connects to this little girl named Petey, who appears to be a loner that doesn't really get along with anyone there. So May kind of sees herself in Petey a bit and thinks that, you know, maybe this is where she can find a friend. So one day she brings Susie, the doll in the glass case, to the daycare to share with the kids and introduce them to her friend. And the kids end up breaking the glass and totally destroying Susie and, you know, in a way destroying May herself. So May returns to her apartment, where she tries to console herself with her new cat, Loopy. But because Loopy is a cat, and as we all know, cats are assholes, Loopy does not respond to May when she calls her over. So May snaps and chucks a handmade ashtray at Loopy, killing the cat. May then tries to connect with a punk who she meets randomly at a bus stop or a bench on the street somewhere. When she brings the punk back to her house and he finds Loopy's dead body in the freezer and panics, May kills him. And after she has a minute to kind of reflect on what she's done, she says to herself, I need more parts. All right, so then we cut to Halloween night. May makes herself a costume so she can resemble Susie. So now she's kind of like embodying Susie, the doll, out of the case. She goes and visits Polly and kills her. And then when Ambrosia shows up shortly after, May kills Ambrosia as well, taking the parts from each of them that she so covets. Polly's neck and Ambrosia's legs, to be specific. May then goes to Adam's house, where he is celebrating Halloween with his new fling or girlfriend or somebody new. And as we've said, May is obsessed with Adam's hands. So she kills Adam, takes his hands. She kills the girlfriend and takes her ears because she was admiring her earrings. And then she takes all these, you know, quote unquote, best parts of each victim back home and stitches together a new friend who she names Amy, who is my new queer icon. May looks at Amy and is obsessed with her because Amy is constructed of all the best parts and has no flaws. But then she realizes Amy is unable to see her. So as a final piece, May gouges out her lazy eye and gives it to Amy to see. And the film ends with Amy coming to life, it would appear, and reaching up and caressing May's cheek as they lay together. And that is May. What'd you think?
I mean, I definitely enjoy a little queer content. And so I think that was a great choice. I also enjoy the narrative of, if you try so hard to be perfect, you're going to come to some kind of bad end. Because I am more on the train of trying to accept yourself and be comfortable with who you are. So I like the narrative. It was also funny, which is helpful for me not being a horror person. Like when grotesque things happened, I was like laughing. So that was the campiness was great for me.
Yeah, this film definitely has a high level of camp and humor. So it does make this a kind of easier film if you're not really a big horror fan, or if you want to watch a film with somebody who's not a big horror fan. There's, as Heather said, there's a good amount of comedy kind of counteract the ickiness of it all.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a lot to this film. It is super queer. So because we are a queer horror podcast, we're going to start with that. So a major, very obvious theme that comes right out of the jump of this movie is this idea of hiding a flaw or the pursuit of perfection. May's flaw, as we, you know, the visual flaw is her lazy eye. The deeper quote-unquote flaw would be like her just weird personality, which if we're looking at this as code, that would be, you know, her queerness, her, you know, that's her being in the closet, so to speak. You know, you gotta hide that and lock that down so people will like you.
Yeah, I think also doing a lot of work in therapy and finding I have all of these masking behaviors to make me appear neurotypical that I didn't even realize I was hiding these things. Like, you just edit them out when people continually perceive you as somehow being bizarre. It's like, okay, so noted, like I have to, if I don't look people in the eyes, they get nervous. And so I'm like, okay, every so often I have to look people in the eyes. I think that the queer metaphor, also the sort of atypical brain metaphor, works both ways.
Yeah, definitely. I've been out of therapy for a while. I'm well past due to get back into it, so I guess I haven't had that on the brain. But now that you mention it, that makes a lot of sense, and that's a good point, because we do say, you know, you got to hide all of that, and you know, mental issues are just as serious as, or just as regular as like physical. You know, if you see someone with a broken arm in a cast, you're not like, oh, what a fucking freak with their broken arm.
And I definitely feel like the mother is hiding the daughter's, like encouraging the daughter to hide her physical differences, but also any kind of the daughter speaking up for what she wants is not allowed, is not welcomed. It's not part of the conversation. The conversation is, what will other people think of us?
There's one moment, the mom is really only in the movie for like less than 2 minutes,
but in her daughter's psyche for the rest of her life.
Oh, and bitch, that is a mouthful. Listen, we probably all realize that our parents at some point really fucked our brains up, and it's kind of wild to actually be witnessing that in real time happening to May, because she is a sweet little girl to begin with. The first way they try to treat May's lazy eye is to give her an eye patch so the quote-unquote normal eye can just do its thing, but then the eye patch draws more attention to the underlying issue, so then the mom's like, okay, use your hair to cover up the eye patch. It's just like, you know, you can never really reach that level of perfection.
What, you know? Whatever you're working on, whatever is makes you different or is hard for you, you should just hide it and work it out on your own and not make it anybody else's business.
Right, exactly. But the one moment with the mom that really kind of like, I just got me was when she gives May this doll, Susie, in this glass case. It's originally wrapped up in wrapping paper because I think it's May's birthday, or maybe
it's her birthday and there's nobody there but her parents.
Yeah, but her mom is just this crazy weird perfectionist. She gives her this gift and May goes to open it, and as we all do, tears the wrapping paper, and the mom gets upset about that and says, now the wrapping paper's ruined. Like, bitch, what? Unless you're living on some mega budget and you're gonna reuse that wrapping paper, which, no shade in that game, shit, I would do that. Like, what? So there's this clear impact, you know, how parents can shape a child's mentality. On the flip side of that, we have Holly, who is insanely confident, like just like oozes confidence. As I said, she's got this, there's really no better way to describe her than like a fuckboy. She has that real like player mentality. The things she says to May are just almost like cheesy pickup lines, but she's just like so cool, calm, collected. She shows up to work as a receptionist at a vet's office wearing like beautiful dresses and stuff. Like, she really is just like all put together. But May discovers Polly has this really big mole on her finger, which May identifies as an imperfection. But Polly says that her grandmother always told her flaws are what make us special. So it's just kind of interesting to see that difference in I guess, like, upbringing and support, you know, those different support systems you have. And that kind of really also stood out to me in terms of the queer perspective. You know, when I first came out as gay when I was in high school, my parents are divorced. So I really almost had, like, two separate coming out experiences in two separate households. And though everyone's, you know, fine, cool with it now, my mother and my father took my coming out very differently, and therefore I felt I had different types of support systems from them. Luckily, I feel very grateful that I had support from both of them from the jump, but they just kind of varied in the levels of support. Therefore, I felt like I could talk to my mom about certain things that I may not be able to talk to my dad about, and so on and so forth. And I feel like even outside of queerness, that's something probably everyone can identify with, but it's that kind of, like, the building up of confidence aspect that I think proves to be so important. And I feel like for parents, I don't know if it's like I don't have children, I probably never will, so I don't know if it's like the stress of raising kids or just dealing with them or what, but I feel like in the moment parents don't really realize the impact they're having on their kids developing psyche and sense of, like, self-worth and self-confidence, you know?
Yeah, my dad had died just a few years before I came out, and I came out to my mom, and my mom had reacted to my dad's death by becoming very into Christianity, and so I had a reaction from her that she had not given to any of my gay friends. She was, like, everybody's mom and everybody loved her, but when I came out, it was like being attracted to somebody of the same sex is like being an alcoholic. It's like something you're born with, and it's like you're born to deal with, and you need to deal with it and don't tell anybody. And it was weird because my mom had previously always been on my side and been very supportive. But the happy part of this story is that, you know, 20 some odd years after I came out to my mom, she is a beacon of hope in rural Virginia with my brother and sister. They're a lot younger, so, like, all of the gay teens in Virginia had my mom telling them it's okay. I used to be really against it because I thought that was important to God, and so your parents may someday change their mind too. So that part is sweet, but it was very rough at the time, and definitely I think I identify with May being told to hide parts of herself, obviously.
Yeah. No one forced me to hide anything, but it was my dad strongly encouraged it at first, for sure. So when my parents got divorced, they both got remarried, and my dad had another child. So she's, like, much younger than me. She's 8 years younger than me. So when I came out, I was 16, I think. So she was roughly 8. And that was the one area that I wasn't allowed to talk about. Like, I couldn't talk about being gay or mention gay or anything in front of her, which, like,
how old was she when she figured it out?
I don't even know, to be honest. I certainly never had the conversation with her, and I never, like, changed my behavior. I never, you know, like, acted butch or, like, said I had a girlfriend. If I had a boyfriend, I mean, I never had anybody, so I didn't talk about that regardless. But, like, I don't know. It was just like, if I was talking to somebody, like my brother or like my dad or something, about something gay, and she walked in and be like, oh, like, you're just here, and it, like, for what? You know, it's not like I was talking about getting fisted or something, you know?
No, I don't understand that impulse that people have, that it's inappropriate to talk about anything related to a homosexual relationship in front of children. It's like you talk about heterosexual stuff in front of children.
Literally every Disney movie, at least, you know, when we were coming up and they were all romances, ends with a makeout between, you know, a straight couple.
Yeah.
You know, like, Disney, literally, no joke, Disney was my first connection to, like, open mouth kissing. Because I'll never forget, Aladdin and Jasmine are clearly open mouth kissing. Like, there's clearly some time, and good for them because they're both hot, you know, like, let me squeeze in. But, like, anyway, so, okay, we're getting way off. But so May has no self-esteem. She's, like, hella awkward. She has no friends except for dolls. And that's something that you really come to see throughout this. It seems like May has only developed the social skills for interacting with inanimate objects that can't speak back, that you're having conversations with either, like, in your head or just totally one-sided.
Yeah. Which is an interesting part of the film, because we see the mom give her this gift on her birthday, and she's like, you know, she's very special. She has to stay inside the case. This is the first time I ever made Jessa stay inside this case, but she's going to be your friend. Like, you have a friend now. Yeah, so there's, like, this moment of seeing her interact with the doll over the years, and it becomes clear that this is the only creature with whom she exchanges. And, like, obviously you can't exchange. The mom tries to treat her like a doll, like all the other little kids look like. It's maybe the 80s, and she is wearing, like, a very, like, mid-century dress kind of schoolgirl look.
The costuming turned out to play a much more important role in this film. They use costuming to kind of make comments like what Heather just addressed about how it made difference from everybody, but also to kind of show May's clothing and her style evolves and improves throughout the film. And it kind of mirrors her evolving and, like, strengthening confidence in herself and what she's looking for. And then when we see her eventually, when she's fully in the Susie getup, she's like a whole new person, but we're going to get to that. The other thing that I wanted to address in terms of this whole hiding of flaws is May's interaction with these blind children. She sees them, so that catches her attention. And then she is further intrigued by this little girl, Petey, who seems to be a loner that none of the kids want to play with. So May, of course, sees herself in this girl and wants to kind of reach out to her. So she volunteers to work with them and immediately tries to connect with Petey. And the thing that is, I guess, the obvious message here is because these kids are blind, they can't see, so to speak, May's weirdness. And that's the thing that kind of feels like she's safe to be herself and not be judged so much. When May meets Petey, she's making an ashtray, which is really hilarious because this girl's like, I don't know, 8?
And May's like, do you smoke?
Yeah, she goes up to meet this girl and she's working with Clay and she's like, what are you making? And she's like, an ashtray.
Oh, and the cigarettes from the boyfriend. So they're little penises that she doesn't know what to deal with.
Oh.
Anna Faris is constantly taking cigarettes out of the main character's mouth.
Hold on, we need to pause on that imagery because I never caught that. Okay, so to catch you all up, what Heather's referring to here, when May meets Adam and they start having their little fling, the first night they actually speak to each other, Adam offers May a cigarette, which May clearly does not know what to do with. Like, it's like giving a child a cigarette and being like, here you go, girl, smoke this. Like, it's like she's so fumbly and weird. He tells her to puff on it and puffs it like she's trying to suck a dick for the first time.
He tells her to practice.
Oh, see, this is why I watch movies with you. You catch things that I'm somehow too stoned to catch. I don't know how you were, but let's move on. So, as we've touched on, May's main prerogative throughout this film is making friends. Is that prerogative? Is that priority?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, those, like, that's my prerogative. Anyway, so May is trying to make friends. It does appear that it's kind of like a romance thing between her and Adam because, like I said, in many ways, this movie reads as like a romantic comedy. So at first, her relationship with Adam and subsequently Polly seems like a romantic thing. But then once May realizes she only likes them for certain parts, she suddenly doesn't see them as people. She just sees them as like bearers of the parts that she needs. And when she has this realization that all she cares about are certain parts, later on in the film, she runs into Adam, and when he leaves, she says bye hands. Like, she doesn't even like acknowledge Adam. She's just like there for the hand. Like, she's the best. I fucking love May. Angela Bettis, who plays May, plays the creepy weirdo so well. I just love her. So May has been trying to make friends since day one. And I wanted to talk about the concept of like making friends, because this is something I've been talking with people about a lot recently, because it feels like, you know, when you're younger and you're dealing with all of these insecurities and trying to develop your like identity and sense of self while still trying to kind of like be cool and be popular and have friends, at least me, when I was going through that, I would think like, okay, well, when I'm an adult and I'm like confident and know who I am, it'll be so easy to make friends. But I've come to find that despite that part is true, I have become much more confident and much more self-assured as I've grown up. I find that making friends is a lot harder because we're not really in those scenarios. You know, we're not like in class with the same people all the time, you know, and really aside from like your job, if you're working with people, there's not many opportunities as an adult to make friends organically, you know, unless you're gonna go like join, I don't know, like a sporting league or something.
For me, I feel like it's hard to connect with people because I kind of have out of sight, out of mind thing. But when I'm with somebody that I love, it's great and it feels so good, but thinking far enough ahead to plan a hangout, and then I'm always worried, what if I don't feel like it that day? And then I just get stuck and I don't make the plans, and the things that happen are the things that happen last minute, and that's it. And there's less opportunities for last minute in pandemic world.
You know, as you were saying that, I started to think about how, especially that idea of making plans now for like in advance, and then that day comes and you're like, I don't really want to do that. Like, I think that's like my favorite, canceling plans is like my favorite activity. And in a way, it kind of makes it seem like having friends, like just the knowledge that you have friends out there to do stuff with, is really the end game. It's like doing stuff with them and actively like connecting with them doesn't even seem to be the priority. So in a way, adult friendship is kind of like having a bunch of fucking dolls. People that you can talk to when you need them, but otherwise you don't have to bother
take them
with.
Off the shelf when you want to.
Uh-huh. Wow, my mind is blown right now because I didn't even look this deep when we watched it earlier. This wasn't even in my notes. I just had this revelation because of what you said. You're so, see, you're so wise. You're one of those people that when I get together with you, you and I have insane energy that kind of feeds and builds off each other. This is why we worked so well together in our burlesque days, because the ideas and the just like the mentalities are just bah, 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 bah. It's like pong.
And this is what I am realizing, is that although I can do this work to get similar interactions out of other people, I don't go back and spend time with the people with whom it's easiest to have this kind of interaction. Like, if I had been more purposely seeking you out, my life would be easier because I could just talk like this. But I'm just like always hoping that whatever person wanders in my way, I'll be like, yeah, I'll get something good out of them.
Yeah, no, I completely understand and agree with that. I mean, to pull back the curtain, Heather and I, before today, you and I hadn't seen each other in, I would say probably, I don't think I saw you pre-pandemic. So like at this point, years. So yeah, I totally get that. So in a way, it's kind of like, May, what are you even working for? It's kind of like what you were saying, that kind of that fight for perfection ultimately leads to disappointment. In a way, all of the people she sought friendship with, from the dude she's kind of dating all the way to this stranger she meets at a bus stop, they all find a way to just, even the cat find a way to disappoint her.
Right.
And ultimately kind of give her exactly what she wasn't looking for, fueling that insecurity and that unhappiness and that loneliness when she would have been better off just staying by herself with her fucking dolls.
Yes. Yeah.
So throughout the film, May makes her own clothes, and we've already kind of touched upon this a lot, until eventually taking on a full like Susie drag form. And as her clothing progresses, so does her confidence, until when she is dressed as Susie, even the way she speaks, when she leaves the voicemail for Polly, like her cadence, her breath, it's all like,
and she is in full Susie the doll face. She has whited out her skin. She's put on makeup. The character is not wearing makeup for most of the movie.
Yes. And her hair is usually like either up or like in some sort of pigtail action. And then for this, she like does the whole straight down back. See, the gays were always like, oh my God, the hair. How's the hair? So I wanted to kind of briefly step away from the film to talk to you about your experience as Grampy Knockers. So Heather's burlesque character is a male-presenting character named Grampy Knockers, who is a old man with a really gross jangling dick that Heather created, but also huge knockers that Heather naturally possesses.
Accurate.
Yeah. So I was fortunate enough to be in Heather's life regularly as her roommate when she was creating Grampy Knockers. So I kind of got to see the birth of him. Mm-hmm. And I also got to see the change in you from when you're naturally yourself, and then when you don your Grampy gear and get into character. So Grampy is a really, really gross old man. Most of his numbers are about just perving out and really creeping out the audience. And as my character was very much that schoolboy thing, you can imagine the kind of numbers Heather and I would put together and throw in some like cold hot dogs and like cream spinach. It's a Grampy and Christian number. But I wanted to ask you, you know, what is it like for you when you perform as Grampy? Like, what is it like to get into that headspace? Because you really do, like, everything about you changes.
Well, that's very cool to hear. Thank you. Grampy was born out of a desire for me to get more in my body. And I auditioned for a burlesque troupe. It was a very queer troupe, Liberty City Kings Drag and Burlesque. And so it being so queer centered, I was trying to focus on some part of me that identified as masculine. And I actually always thought I would grow up to be an old man. I always pictured it. I was very into this movie called IQ with Meg Ryan and Tim Robbins, and Walter Matthau plays Albert Einstein, and he has sidekicks of multiple old men, crazy professor sidekicks. And so I was like, I'm gonna hang out with Walter Matthau and like these old weird physics professors. Like, definitely that is who child Heather thought adult grown up Heather would be. And I kind of like recalled all of this, and I don't know what it is, but it seemed to me like there was a kind of freedom and power in being an old man. And I obviously, it's complex and fraught, and there are freedoms and there are also, you know, huge obstacles. But that being said, the way I viewed it, and so like I put body hair on myself because I am a naturally very hairy person, and it was something that I think I was like working through in my psyche. And I just was like, I made the chest merkin piece, but I didn't want to bind because I'm like, I know plenty of old men that have breasts. Like, this is not a female exclusive body part. So I did that. I made like a happy trail. At first, Grampy just had a happy trail and then some hairs coming out of the butt crack up the back. And then eventually I did give Grampy a dick, which was made from stockings with a little bit of pillow stuffing and nine pennies in each ball, I felt was the appropriate weight. And a tiny little dick that's basically just a head with like swinging balls. It's great.
The balls, yes. Oh my God. First of all, I'm dead over the fact that a set of balls cost 18 cents. But the dick and balls that you created, every time I see it, it's something that like haunts my dreams. It's like, and I'm into old men, especially like I get down with skeezy old men. I'm here for it. Like, that's hot to me. But God, that dick is frightening every time I see it.
Yeah.
And, and even when the balls just flop out, oh God.
And the things that worked out for me as I was like trying to do these numbers was basically the enjoyment of really creeping people out while I could see they were also turned on and conflicted about it. And that is,
yes,
that is like the sweet spot that I found that I kept trying to mine.
I mean, you seem to be quite successful with it, because that is typically the reaction that audiences get from you, or you, that we get from what you get from audiences. Wow, I can't speak. So I don't know how method you got with Grampy. It is very interesting to find that you used to think you would grow up to be an old man, but you were talking about the freedom that you feel like old men have, regardless of, you know, the many limitations that we can talk on and on about. But that freedom, have you ever seen Johnny Knoxville does an old man character? He's done it for a couple of Jackass films, and then had his own, like the old man character had his own movie where they basically would just do a bunch of scenes with him as this old man interacting with people in public but act totally crazy.
Yeah.
So there is that, like, that aspect of freedom.
There's also Betty White for a while had like a show where she would put actual old people in public doing those interactions.
Yes. Yes,
you remember that?
I remember that. I never watched it, but I remember seeing ads for it, and I was like, wow, this is what we're getting to.
I feel like, yeah, there's something about the character that you don't... There's a layer. It's the same way I feel about Louise and Bob's Burgers. Like, the freedom to be an instigator and not worry about if other people are comfortable, or if somebody understood you right, or you understood them, or if they really... Like, I'm just so anxious about all of these things, and there is something about an old man in my mind that does not have to give a fuck about any of that.
That's awesome. And that's really like, I mean, that's one of the things that's great about performing, and especially about burlesque, is like kind of tapping into a character that is embodying your insecurities in a way, you know, or like living through your insecurities or something like that, you know?
I definitely, another reason is that I love dancing, but I am a clumsy person. I am an awkward person. I just don't think there's a world in which I compete with people who are skilled dancers with a lot more, I don't know, natural balance and grace than I have.
Yeah. So kind of fits the character. I mean, hey, it works.
Yeah.
Because it also gives you the freedom to do like really grotesque things, even simple grotesque things. There's this photo of you from a number. I don't know if it was one that we were doing together or you're doing by yourself, but you're eating a hot dog, I think. And it's like such an off-putting picture because you're like making the grossest face. But like you really lean into that when you're performing as Grampy. Do you think that the Grampy character and the Grampy geesh, if you will, makes you feel more comfortable doing that? Or do you think that as Heather, you could get up on stage and be as overtly grotesque?
I don't. I would love to meld that. Like it would be cool if Grampy got me there. But I mean, I literally flossed my teeth on stage.
So gross.
And like I can't fathom having the ovaries to do that in real life as me, as any kind of more character that's more close to me.
That's awesome though. I love that we have like these ways of getting that freedom. And to tie it back into May and also the queer thing, it makes me think of how, and this may not be an exclusively queer experience, but I think it definitely does pertain to queer folks, this kind of need to develop a public facing persona and the identity that you allow people to see. And part of that experience is this kind of like trying on of different roles, you know, kind of like how you're saying that getting into the Grampy year allows you to get more comfortable with things you're naturally insecure about yourself.
Yeah.
You know, May putting on the Susie stuff allowed her to tap into that confidence of like getting what she wanted and, you know, getting that perfection. So in your experience as Heather, have you gone through phases of trying on different like identities and roles and stuff?
Yes. Yeah. Dovetailing off the Grampy thing and the body hair thing, I stopped removing my facial hair during the pandemic, and I had already stopped shaving my legs and my armpits some years ago, but this was like a last. I didn't think I was going to be able to let this go, and I don't even think I realized what my facial hair was like, because I just plucked it intensely all the time, and it was huge upkeep and like huge irritation to my skin and something I worried about constantly. So I'm trying to be a female-bodied person with facial hair and body hair, and it's dark and it's noticeable, but it's also like it's not full enough or symmetrical enough for to be like really pleasing to me. So I guess I don't know if I'm the person that doesn't do anything about their body hair or this one particular portion of my body hair. And I don't know, I don't want to have to commit to all or nothing on the body hair, facial hair count, but I don't know where in between. And it's very hard to tell like what I'm comfortable or uncomfortable with and what is easier. It's a lot easier to, the more you conform and the more you pass as whatever is normal in the society you're in, it's easier. So I don't know if I want to embrace this. Am I just being an asshole because I have the privilege to shave this and I don't? And I don't know. It's a lot of complicated things, but I am trying to deal with what suits me and trying to sort out the systems that are in my head, what's good and what's bad, what I want and what I don't want.
I think that, first of all, thank you for sharing. I think that's awesome. And you also brought up the concept of privilege, because there's, you know, there's definitely layers of that. Like when I first came out, because I had the privilege of being in a school where it was almost entirely accepted, no one ever really gave me shit for being queer, because I had the privilege of having a family that for the most part I had support from them, I had the privilege to go into school and wear a rainbow bell and prance around and be proudly like the gay kid, like that's the gay kid. But like I was kind of forcing myself to be more, I guess, flamboyant and effeminate and stereotypically gay than I actually felt I was.
Oh, yeah. There's 100% a thing where you have to, like, you have to get the rainbow accessories to express outwardly your gayness. And I don't think maybe once a year would I put on something rainbow now. Like, it's not.
Oh, my God. I honestly, like, I respect the rainbow for, you know, its symbolism and what it means for us as a community. I fucking hate rainbow. It's like the tackiest. I wish it was just like a cool symbol, but you know, we gotta be colorful. We gotta keep it bright over here in Alphabet City. All right, so let's wrap that up here. If you need to get in touch with me, if you have any recommendations for films, for guests to interview, for things you want to talk about, if you just want to say hey, you can reach me at notanotherqhp@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Instagram at notanotherqhp. Until next time, stay creepy. Not Another Queer Horror Podcast is recorded, edited, and produced by me, Christian Mingle. All of the music used in this episode is produced by Mr. Fulton.